updating the determination of the moment of death. The agenda that we filed with the University of Toronto is on your source sheet. For decades, medical researchers and legal experts have worked to define a reliable moment of death for purposes including enhancing patient care and protecting medical resources. This past year has seen new efforts in this regard in both Canada and the United States. How does Judaism define the moment of death as it relates to contemporary medical care? And in particular, how does Judaism relate to the phenomenon of partial resurrection and its use in organ transplantation? And that's a really fascinating thing. The truth of the matter is, the discussion about the defining the moment of death and the new policy in that regard is probably old hat for a lot of people here who have looked at the brain death issue before. But the issue of partial resurrection is where things get very interesting. And there's a lot to discuss, so we'll see what we get to. In the links section of this of the source sheet, I just put the link for the evaluation, as well as link for past medical sessions that we've had, and in particular for a shear that I gave in 2019 on the total artificial heart, and that you'll see why it becomes relevant a little bit later. So we're not going to have the standard vignettes here because you don't see cases come up necessarily in medical practice that really involve the discussion of brain death versus cardiac death and things like that, because these tend to come up on a policy level as opposed to on the practice level. The practice level simply, you end up having to implement the policy that's been set. So instead of the standard vignettes, I give you four questions because this is the season for four questions. First, how is the definition of death used in Canada and the U.S. evolving? The truth is the one in Canada evolved. The one in the U.S. is kind of on hold right now. Second, Canada has now adopted brain death as the standard. What is the definition of death in halacha? Third, a key point of conflict based on the revision. What is the status of patients whose organs have stopped functioning if we are capable of reversing that stoppage? And that's where we get into the partial resurrection discussion. And finally, if we get to it, a practical ethical question. May a Jewish anesthesiologist aid in thoracoabdominal normothermic regional perfusion to enable a heart transplant? So what we're talking about there is, I think I pronounced that right. I hope I did. That was actually my first attempt to say that out loud. Okay, I got the thumbs up. But what that's talking about is using a particular blend of fluids to keep the organ functioning at a certain level in order to enable enable transplant. And the question is, if you believe that this isn't appropriate for reasons we'll discuss, then are you actually allowed to aid in doing that to make a heart transplant possible? And this goes back to a question I was asked by an anesthesiologist in 2015, and I put the question to halachic authorities who I greatly respect, and I got different answers. So I'm hoping that we'll get a chance to discuss how that happened and what it means in practice. So that's a lot to get to, but hopefully we'll get to some of this. So the history of defining life, because I don't like to call it defining death. It's really about defining life. So on a practical level, in the general system of looking at this, meaning in secular society, in general society, and in Jewish society and Jewish thought, there are three interlocking systems which may be considered essential to life. There is the circulatory system involving the heart and delivery of blood. There is the pulmonary system, the lungs processing of oxygen. And there's the nervous system, right? The brain, the spine, the nerves. Obviously, all of these work together to keep the body going. If you don't have, let's say, the pulmonary system processing oxygen, the blood going around the body isn't going to do much. You still need to make sure that you've got that you have oxygen in it in order to keep things going, and so on. And you all know how these interlock. So for most of human history, people died by having all three of those systems collapse in short order because they're interconnected. So the heart technically is something of an autonomous muscle, but it needs regulation of the pressure in the arteries by the brain. My understanding is it comes from the hypothalamus and the brain stem, although I'm not really clear on the different roles, but that it's coming from multiple places that regulation takes place. But the regulation is necessary. The heart may be able to beat, but it's going to need some assistance to keep on going. The lungs need regulation from the respiratory control center, which is in the brain stem. That becomes very important in this conversation. The brain isn't going to function long without oxygen, which is delivered from the lungs via the blood. So these systems interlock, and generally speaking, again, most of human history, if one of these stopped, pretty soon all three were going to be stopped, and people died, and that was that. But today, medicine enables us to replace some of these functions. So the brain can stop sending messages, but we can keep breathing and circulation going through machines and medication. The lungs can stop, and we can replace them with a ventilator. So the question arises, at what point has somebody passed away? When do we stop treating? And who is supposed to decide? How are they supposed to decide? These are the questions that come into trying to determine when somebody is alive. That's the idea. I see a note in the chat. Is that really true? Is the research animal, no doubt, looking at anencephalic animals by birth or intervention, and how long the heart works without CNS input? There definitely is research on how long the heart works without CNS input. My understanding was that it wouldn't last long without something to regulate it, but if someone wants to speak to that, we certainly have enough doctors here. I don't need to pretend to be one.
Taryn, this is your territory.
Okay, so we'll just take it as a given. If the doctors want to speak up, that's fine. Otherwise, I'll just I will say that my research is that it doesn't last that long. But if anybody wants to weigh in with evidence, I'm more than happy to hear. Okay. So, in terms of how we define life. First of all, I wanted to show you the paper in source number one, which was very useful for me, not this time around, but the last time I gave a shiur on this issue. This is an article from the Vad Halacha of the RCA. This was a committee of experts who interviewed other great experts on the issue of determination of death. In 2010, they put out a paper, Halachic Issues in the Determination of Death and an Organ Transplantation, and it is linked there in source number one. It's long. It's not the sort of thing that you just sit down and read, but it is extremely well done. It is thorough, it is well organized, and it gives you a good background on multiple points of view within Judaism as well as biological background. For this. So I definitely recommend it. The reason why this is hard, this whole issue, is because death fundamentally is a convention society adopts. Whether society decides on the definition of death based on divine revelation or political structures, fundamentally, the method society uses to decide this is what we call death, this is what we call sy a symptom of death, may include factors which are not directly medical or scientific at all. There are lots of things that go into that decision. On the other hand, science and medicine are necessary in order for society to interpret what's happening and to apply the definitions that they want to apply. So, for example, if society says the definition of death is when there is no cardiac activity, when is that? What if it can be restarted? What if the reason the heart stopped functioning was an acute trauma, but or some condition that's going to pass soon? You have to ask the doctor in order to know what you're seeing. If the definition is when the brain dies, so what does that mean? Do you mean every cell in the brain? Do you mean particular parts of the brain? Again, what if it's due to some temporary condition? And again, what if it can be restored? If the definition is when there is no organized motor activity beyond reflexes, so you need medical science in order to know when that's been, when that's actually been crossed. You can't establish a definition without the doctors to tell you what you're working with. So, as of 2023, the USA had a standard which accepted neurological and cardiological evidence of death separately. In 2023, Canada adopted a purely neurological approach in which cardiac death is accepted only as a symptom of neurological death. So, in the event that the heart isn't functioning at all, that may be a symptom of the fact that the brain is not functioning. We'll talk about that. I'll show you that from a paper. But let's go back to the beginning, the modern beginning of this topic. And people have joined, so I'm going to put the link for the source sheet again in the chat. Okay. So if you take a look at source number two, this is from an article in the journal Nature. What does brain dead really mean? A fellow by the name of Max Kozlov. And he writes, current legal definitions around the world generally allow for two types of death. When heart and respiratory functions stop irreversibly, that's one. Or when crucial functions of the brain are lost, right? Either heart and respiration or crucial functions of the brain. Historically, these two have been closely entwined. Stop the heart and the brain is dead in minutes. Stop the entire brain functioning and the heart stops beating, right? We talked about that. But medical advances in the 1950s, such as modern ventilators, meant that the two types of death could be separated, like we've talked about. Such technologies, along with improved methods of measuring brain function, prompted the formation of a committee at Harvard University in Cambridge in 1968. The members developed a definition of irreversible coma or brain death that was controversial at the time. So they wanted to go with what are called the Harvard criteria to determine a definition of death based on the death of the brain. I see that somebody wrote a message in the chat, but as a general rule, I'm not going to be monitoring the chat. It's too difficult for me to keep track of it because people sign in the chat, and I'm also trying to look at you and look at my notes. So it doesn't work so well. So in general, if someone has a comment, I'm going to advise you, interrupt me. That's your best bet. I will look at this one because I hadn't made that announcement yet. We get some idea of what the heart does without neural input from the without neural input from the brain, from cardiac transplant patients, from patients with severe autonomic neuropathies. They're at risk of sudden death, but can last some significant time. This is definitely true that they can last some significant time. I didn't know that that could be years. That's a very interesting idea. That they could actually last for years. Do me a favor, not in the chat, but overall, just send me like by email, old-fashioned material on that. It doesn't have to be right now, but I would love to know more about that. Thank you. So, the Harvard criteria are unreceptivity and unresponsivity, meaning that the brain is completely not responsive even to the most painful stimuli. No spontaneous breathing, and that's the apnea test. No spontaneous muscular movements. No reflexes, meaning not only that the brainstem reflexes aren't there, but in general, reflexes are not around, as well as a flat EEG, a flat encephalogram. So, what they're really talking about in the Harvard criteria in 1968 is loss of function of the entire cerebrum and the brainstem. This is known as the total brain standard or the whole brain standard, resulting in coma, no spontaneous respiration, that's important. And loss of all brainstem-based reflexes. Reflexes that are controlled by lower synapses, though. So, for example, you hit someone's knee with a hammer, and the foot jolts. Flexing of the foot, those could still remain. That would not be considered a sign that the person is actually alive. Only the reflexes that are based in the brain. That's the Harvard criteria. Opponents argued that many more functions are managed by the body and will continue even after you've satisfied the Harvard criteria. The body is able to fight infection. The body is able to heal wounds. The body can maintain much of homeostasis. The Nishmas Avraham, Rabbi Dr. Avraham Sofer Abraham, who is not a fan of the brain death standard, lists in Yoredeya Shin Lamed Tes, he lists a lot of evidence that the brain and the body do not shut down upon brainstem death. Children will maintain the ability to mature. They can go through puberty. Pregnant women are able to carry a fetus to term. The reality is that there's an awful lot going on in the body, even after the Harvard criteria have been satisfied. Nonetheless, in 1981, the United States passes something called the Uniform Definition of Death Act. Canada, on the other hand, was not interested in being uniform. It's a mosaic, not a melting pot. And it remained that way until 2023. If you take a look on the sheet at source number three, this gives you a little bit of background on the Uniform Determination of Death, Uniform Definition of Death Act. By the 1980s, this is from an article that appeared last year in the Canadian Journal of Anesthesia, Rationale for Revisions to the Definition of Death and Criteria for its Determination in Canada. By the 1980s, the term brain death to describe the total loss of brain function had gained currency, and criteria for DNC were increasingly accepted by medical professionals. DNC, referring to death by neurological criteria. Yet, stimulated by the need for greater certainty in the face of variable practices and legislation governing death's definition and determination, commissions in both the US and Canada convened to determine whether a brain-based definition of death ought to be enshrined in law. They said, hey, let's ask this question. Should we find a way to make a law that will say brain death is the definition of death? So, in the 1981 US President's Commission recommended that states adopt its proposed Uniform Determination of Death Act, a statute describing legal death, to avert the uncertainty and inconsistency that would result if none were adopted. The commission did not recommend a unified brain-based definition of death, but instead confined its recommendations to the level of general physiologic standards for death determination. So, to be clear, this UDDA, Uniform Definition of Death Act, was not a law of brain death is now the definition of death in the United States. Rather, it offered multiple options. It offered the option of brain death, and it offered the option of cardiac death. The commission proposed that alternative circulatory slash respiratory and neurologic standards ought to feature in the UDDA for two reasons. First, the projected incidence of neurologic death was low, meaning that the circulatory slash respiratory standard would remain adequate in the overwhelming majority of cases. It's not like you were seeing a lot of cases come up where you needed to invoke a brain death standard. Second, supplementing rather than supplanting the traditional cardiorespiratory approach to death determination was thought to be more acceptable from a societal perspective, meaning those of us who are not fans of brain death would be very unhappy if you created a law that said, okay, brain death is the sole standard. So what they said was, in addition to the existing circulatory respiratory standard, we're also going to recognize a brain death standard. Nonetheless, the authors of the report warned that, quote, the use of two standards in a statute should not be permitted to obscure the fact that death is a unitary phenomenon. Okay, fine, good luck. That was what they said, at any rate. So what happens in Canada? Well, continuing in source three, in contrast to the US President's Commission in 1981, the Law Reform Commission of Canada recommended that a single unified brain-based definition of death be enshrined in legislation. They said, let's swing for the fences. We're going to try to get everybody on board with a brain death standard. The commission averred that, quote, a person is dead when an irreversible cessation of all that person's brain function has occurred, but allowed this could be inferred based on either circulatory respiratory criteria or when organ supporting technologies are in place by neurologic criteria. They wanted brain death as the standard, but they said that could come about via evidence from the halting of the circulatory system, the respiratory system. It didn't have to be based on the brain. Despite strong endorsement by Canadian Medical Association, a host of other medical professional organizations, Parliament did not follow this recommendation, although Manitoba did. This resulted in a patchwork of legal approaches in the common law and legislation governing death's definition in the Canadian provinces and territories. So that 2023 rolls around and the provinces all have different standards. And that's what you see in the next part of source number three. Just watching the time go by and realizing I need more of the time for myself and not for source number three, I'm summing up what you see in source number three. There's a description here of what the different provinces are doing. And what they ultimately decide to do is to say, across Canada, only brain death is the standard. You can still use circulatory, respiratory death as symptomatic of the death of the brain, but fundamentally, as of 2023, the standard is brain death in Canada. If you take a look at source number four, a brain-based definition of death, dot, 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 death is defined as the permanent cessation of brain function, i.e. brain function is lost, will not resume spontaneously, and will not be restored through intervention. I'm going to come back to that. And is characterized by the complete absence of any form of consciousness, wakefulness, awareness, and the absence of brainstem reflexes, including the ability to breathe independently. This can result from cessation of blood circulation to the brain after circulatory arrest and or from devastating brain injury. Residual brain cell activity that is not associated with the presence of consciousness or brainstem function does not preclude death determination. In other words, not every cell in the brain has to be dead in order for this standard to be achieved. Death cannot be declared if there is any level of consciousness remaining and or residual brainstem function, regardless of how diminished. Yes, Leia.
I have a new computer and I was playing with it. I didn't realize it stayed up there, but that's okay. In the emergency room, though, you're still using the definition of circulatory death because someone will come in, maybe they've had a massive heart attack. You do CPR, you can't get them back. You're not doing any brain tests.
Right.
It is based on...
Correct. And that was their point, you know, regarding the fact that the Uniform Determination of Death Act did not impose just the brain standard was because it's not so practical in a lot of circumstances as you're describing. So that's 100% true. So Canada now has this definition, which is based on the brain, even if the application of it isn't necessarily going to be, let's test the brain function. The United States stalled out on trying to get to this point. It didn't work out that way because different parts of society are definitely not on the same page in this regard. There's a great article that I saw, I'm blanking on which journal it was in, describing the disappointment of the people who were the architects of the attempt in the United States with the Uniform Law Commission, how they came in thinking they were going to simplify everything and solve everything, and now they're just hoping they didn't make things worse. But in any case, where does all of this leave us in terms of halacha, in terms of Jewish law? Where does that come in? So, three sources in the Gemara drive this conversation. And as I said when I began the shiur, for those who have already been engaged in learning about this topic before, a lot of this, maybe all of it, will be old hat. But let's see. The first source, the classic source, the one that every conversation has to begin with, is the Gemara in Yuma or Yoma, Pehei Amud Aleph, 85a. The discussion of somebody who is buried under a collapsed building, and we are digging them out, it's Shabbos, and we're violating Shabbos in order to get to them, because that's what you're supposed to do. But once we determine that this person has passed away, then we don't keep digging. At that point, we say, wait till after Shabbos in order to take care of them. So when you get to part of the body and you don't see signs of life, how do you conclude that this person has passed away? What do you need to see in order to understand that this person has actually passed on? And the answer is unclear. So take a look at the Gemara in source number five. Tanu Rabbanan, our sages taught. Ad heichan hu bodek? How far do you have to look? Meaning, how far do you have to investigate this person's body in order to determine that they have actually passed away? Ad chot mo. So the first view says that you check up to the person's nostrils. V'yesh omrim, and some say ad libo, up until the person's heart. Now, at this stage, pausing there, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know, what did I find first? Did I find the head first? Did I find the feet first? Like, what are we talking about? So that's where we're going to go with this. But the two voices here are either look for the nostrils, meaning respiration, or look for the lave, look for the heart. Is there cardiac function? So if Papa comes in later generation than that initial source is a brisa from the period of the Mishnah. Now we're moving into the times of the Gemara, commenting on it, and Rav Papa says, Machlokes, this debate that we're talking about here of whether you care about the nostrils or whether you care about the heart is mimata lamala. It's talking about where you started at the lower end of the body. So first you found the legs, and now you're working your way up. And you get to the person's chest. And the question is, you don't find a heartbeat. If you found a heartbeat, this person's alive. That was easy. If you don't find a heartbeat, do you keep on going, hoping that you're going to find breath in their nostrils? That's the question. I added it in the words in brackets in the Hebrew, or in the English for that matter as well. Im tzarech livdok ad achotem, do you go all the way to the nose, or do you stop if you're not detecting a heartbeat? And that's where there's a debate. One view is, the first view presented is go to the nostrils, and the second view is no, you stop. If there's no heartbeat, you're done. Aval mimala lemata. However, if Papa says, if you started from the top, if you found the head first and you didn't find breath, kevan debadek le'archot mo, shuv eino tzarech. Once you have checked to the nostrils and you did not find breathing, you are done. If you find the head first and there's no respiration, it's over. If you found the lower part of the body, the trunk first, and there was no heartbeat, then we have a machlokes, then we have a debate. So there are two ways you can read this in terms of trying to figure out what the essential sign of life is. Obviously, this is not having any discussion about neurologic criteria. That's not part of the conversation. But you could read this as supporting respiration as the standard, and you could read it as supporting cardiac function, circulatory function. Why? So, first of all, supporting respiration as the standard. We start from the head and we find no breathing, we stop there. Well, I guess that means that breathing is what matters. And even according to the view that says that when you started from the bottom of the body and you hit the chest and there was no heartbeat, then you stopped, that's because if there's no heartbeat, my assumption is respiration will have already stopped or is going to stop immediately. It's not that the heartbeat is independently significant, but just like in the Canadian system, they're telling you cessation of circulatory function indicates cessation of neurological function. So too, the Gemara is telling you cessation of circulatory function is indicative of cessation of respiratory function as well. So you can read this Gemara that way. That's a legitimate way to read it, and yet that's not the dominant view among halachic authorities. The dominant view in halachic authorities is that it's the heartbeat that actually matters. If you start from the head and you find that there's no breathing, then we tell you to stop because the flip of what we were going to say before, if there's no breathing, then realistically there's no heartbeat. That's the assumption. You don't have breathing, you're not going to have a heart. Whether this is scientifically what we observe today or not doesn't matter. We're talking about the Gemara's perspective on the way things work, and the Gemara is saying, in the event that you're not finding respiration, you aren't going to find the heartbeat either. And then the other way around, when I start from the feet, I have two views as to whether it's sufficient to detect or fail to detect a heartbeat or not. The reason why you have two views is not because some say heartbeat matters and some say heartbeat does not matter. It's a question of whether I trust our inability to find a heartbeat. The heartbeat might just be very faint, and I am not able to detect it, but that doesn't mean circulation isn't happening. It's because I don't necessarily trust my ability to detect a heartbeat. If you take a look at Rashi, which I put in source number five, specifically the second Rashi, Machlokes Tahanach Tanoi, the debate of these Tanoim, the ones from the Brisa, who discuss whether you go to the nostrils or whether you just go to the chest. So he says that debate is Demar Amar Ad Libo. One says check to the heart. Umar Amar Ad Chotmo. The other one says no, check to the nostrils. That is, I just, for time reasons, I'm just going to read my English translation, but you could see the original Hebrew as well. He says, when one finds his feet, that's from bottom to top, when one finds his feet first and one checks toward the head. One says we can determine life at his heart, for his soul beats there. And one says until his nose, as sometimes one cannot detect life at his heart, but it is detected at his nose. So, according to this approach, everybody is in agreement. All the voices in this Gemara in source number five are in agreement that really it's cardiac function that matters. And the only reason to proceed to look for breathing when I can't detect the pulse is because maybe I was unsuccessful in detecting the heartbeat, but that doesn't mean that the heart has actually stopped beating. Rabbi J. David Bleich in source number six sums it up this way. An article in Tradition from 1986. The necessity for examination of the nostrils is based upon the assumption that it is possible for life to exist, even though such life may be undetectable by means of examination of the chest for the presence of a heartbeat. Rashi succinctly comments that the first opinion maintains that examination of the chest is insufficient to determine whether or not life is present, quote, for at times life is not evident at the heart, but is evident at the nose. Right? That was what we just said from my translation. That's Rabbi Bleich. And Rabbi Moshe Feinstein likewise said it in source number seven, reading out my English translation of his work. It is clear and obvious that the nose is not the body part that gives a person life, and it is not at all one of the body parts on which life depends. Meaning, we have in the Gemara a discussion about body parts on which life depends. No one ever says the nose is one of them. He says, rather, the brain and heart give life to a person, including providing the ability to breathe through one's nose. The nose is only the body part through which breathing happens via the brain and heart, and we lack a sign of life other than via the nose, even though it is not the enabler of breath, because we cannot determine well via the heart or navel, and we certainly cannot determine the brain's function. So the way that Rabbi Feinstein frames it, as did Rabbi Bleich, as did Rashi, is to say it's about cardiac function, and I may need to examine respiratory function because I'm not able to detect cardiac function. That's the upshot of source number five, that classic Gemara in Yuma. Are we clear? Well, I'm going to pause here for questions or comments.
I think the last statement about equating what Rav Moshe said to what Rav Bleich said is a bit of a leap. I think it's a broader discussion, but I think I just want to just raise it, and there's lots to be.
No, go for it. In terms of what we brought in number seven, not Rav Moshe's broader writing, what do you see in number seven that disagrees with what Rabbi Bleich wrote?
Well, I mean, the way it was presented was that Rabbi Bleich is going to use cardiac as being the determinant of death, and that is his position. Rav Moshe, on the other hand, he says that the nose is not the seat of the determination,
Yeah.
but that does not necessarily mean that it becomes the heart. He points out that there's also a brain involved as well. You use the nose only whether you're going to use a feather to determine one way or the other, but it is not. With Rav Moshe, there's more latitude. With Rav Bleich, he makes it very clear that he's following, again, opinions of Chacham Tzvi and others, that he's going with the heart.
Right, so
I don't think that we.
I'm only asking in terms of the interpretation of this Gemara, not asking in terms of broader views.
But even from these words, Rav Moshe itself offers more latitude in terms of analyzing. Even this paragraph here, there's room for brain and as well heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just making the point,
that's fair.
There's more room and more latitude there than there is in Rabbi Bleich's writing. Rabbi Bleich makes it very, very clear.
Right. No, I definitely hear you. It's true, right? Rav Moshe did introduce the brain as part of the conversation. Part of that, I think, also is based on the question he was asked, to which he was responding. Rabbi Bleich is writing an article in which he's presenting his perspective. Rav Moshe is answering a shaila. And that I think, frames that as well. But you're right. Rav Moshe does mention brain and explains the absence of brain from the conversation in the Gemara by simply saying, we certainly cannot determine the brain's function. So that's fair. This source is the source that's traditionally brought to support the idea that we would look for cardiac and respiratory function. That's what we would be examining. There is a second source, though, that gets brought into this discussion, and that's source number 8. Mishnah and Ahalos. So the Mishnah here is talking about issues of tumah, of ritual impurity, ritual ineligibility. And it says, Adam, a human being, as well as behemah v'chaya, domestic and wild animals, they don't communicate tumah, this state of impurity, until their lives depart. A creature that is alive will not communicate this tumah. Without going into what tumah is, it doesn't matter for our purposes. If their heads are cut off, then they communicate tumah even if they still spasm, as in the case of a spasmodic tail of a lizard. The term in the original language, mifar keset, right? It is spasming is the best translation that I'm able to offer for that. So what we're saying is, if the animal is alive, if the human being is alive, it will not communicate tumah. In the event that its head is chopped off, it communicates tumah. And don't point to any movement of the body spasmodically. That's not significant for my purposes. Why isn't it significant for my purposes? Where is your delineation of real movement and fake movement? So here you turn to the Rambam in source number 9. The Rambam's commentary on that Mishnah. And he says, this occurs in some types of creatures when the mobilizing force is not spread through all of the organs from a single foundation and source, but is scattered through the body. Okay? It's non-integrated movements. And that I use that term because that's what he's saying here. It's not from a single foundation and source. It is scattered through the body. Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman, in source number 10, an article from that he published in the Torah Matter Journal, seeks to suggest that what the Rambam is saying here is not just that movement that's from a single source matters, movement that's scattered does not, but rather what the Rambam means is movement from the brain. The Rambam did not use the word brain. However, he says that's what the Rambam is talking about. Take a look at number 10. Although the Rambam refers to a central origin of movement, he does not reveal whether this origin is the brain or the heart or perhaps some other organ. From the Rambam's medical writings, however, it is clear what he believed to be the source of movement. We have mentioned above the debate between Aristotle and Galen regarding whether the heart or the brain is the controlling center of sensation and movement. The Rambam explicitly addresses this controversy and supports the position of Aristotle. And here he quotes from the Rambam. I have prefaced my remarks with this introduction in order to stimulate you to critically appraise even a statement of the great sage Galen. The Rambam disagreed with Galen from time to time. You already know that his opinion is that there are three major organs, the heart, the brain, and the liver, and that not one of these can receive its power from another organ under any circumstances. Each one is needed for its own job. The opinion of Aristotle and his followers is, as you know, that there is a single main organ, namely the heart. And the heart sends powers to each of the other organs, and with this power, the other organs perform their specific functions. Therefore, according to the view of Aristotle, the heart sends powers to the brain, And with this power, the brain performs its function, and it, in turn, gives sensation and movement to other organs. So, too, the powers of imagination, thought, and memory are powers that are brought into existence in the brain through the principle that the brain receives from the heart. Similarly, all other organs in the body contain the powers with which they perform their special functions. This thesis of Aristotle is correct and logical, because the brain performs its functions, and likewise every organ performs its functions, and all together they constitute the total life situation of an individual. However, the heart sends the specific power of life to each organ. So Rabbi Dr. Reichman believes that this demonstrates that in the Rambam's mind, movement is rooted in the brain. It is what the brain specializes in. And when the Rambam then talked about in his commentary to the Mishnah in Ahalos, movement being from a single source, he would have meant the brain. That introduces, if you accept that Rambam, that read of the Rambam, that introduces the possibility that when the brain stops dictating or orchestrating organized movement, that could be a definition of death. Even if the heart retains some function, and even if there are living brain cells. And that's the suggestion made in source number 11. Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tendler, Dr. Fred Rosner, in an article in 1989 in the Journal of Halach and Contemporary Society. Based on the position of Rav Moshe Feinstein cited above, and this is their read of Rav Moshe, there is a lot of controversy that I'm sidestepping about how to read Rav Moshe, but based on their explanation of Rav Moshe's position, Rabbi Moshe Tendler, one of the authors of the present essay, has introduced the concept of physiologic decapitation as an acceptable definition of death in Judaism, even if cardiac function has not ceased. The thesis is that absent heartbeat or pulse was not considered a significant factor in ascertaining death in any early religious source. It was never about lacking a heartbeat. Furthermore, the scientific fact that cellular death does not occur at the same time as the death of the human being is well recognized in the earliest biblical sources. The fact that a person could die even if there are cells in the body that are alive and functioning, he says, that's an old idea. The twitching of a lizard's amputated tail or the death throes of a decapitated man were never considered residual life, but simply manifestations of cellular life that continued after death of the entire organism has occurred. So in other words, once you no longer have organized movement, which he hasn't mentioned, but I am implanting in it because I do know that that's what he's talking about. Once the brain is no longer dictating organized movement, even though there is life in cells in the body, even though there are systems that are still doing their job, nonetheless, at that point, the person has passed away. In the situation of the decapitated state, death can be defined or determined by the decapitated state itself, as recognized in the Talmud and the Code of Laws. Complete destruction of the brain, which includes loss of all integrative, regulatory, and other functions of the brain, can be considered physiological decapitation and thus a determinant per se of death of the person. The person could be considered dead because the brain is not regulating movement in the body anymore. Dr. Kirshen.
I wonder if you could use Shrita and Masechet Chulin as a surrogate to direct us in this.
How?
The criteria for killing an animal is reducing blood flow to the brain, effectively.
Yes.
That's not the exact words of the Talmud, I agree.
Yeah. No, but you're right. I mean, in terms of what we're cutting.
Chulin talks explicitly about the animal still moving.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's kosher to eat, and we're not allowed to eat a chai.
Right.
So how do you synthesize those together to support the definition of brain death?
So you're going to, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that since shechita involves cutting off blood flow to the brain, and we are willing to call the animal dead from the time of shechita, even though the only thing that has ceased is blood flow to the brain at that point, that must mean that that's a definition of death. That's your argument.
That must mean it's a component of the definition of breath, of death.
Because it's a requirement for Shlita?
Yeah.
So there's a lot to unpack there. I'm gonna punt on this one because there's more to unpack to discuss there. Maybe we'll discuss further afterwards. We can follow up on it. So this is an approach to defining death. This is the way that Rabbi Tendler, in fact, read the response of Rav Moshe Feinstein. The RCA, in their 2010 paper, disagreed with his read of Rav Moshe Feinstein's Tshuvos, which I'm not going to get into right now. I remember vividly when I was in YU, no, I think when I was in high school, I was in MTA, which is on the Yeshiva University campus, or Yeshiva University is on the MTA campus. But either way, when we were still in high school, they brought my shiur to a classroom where Rav Herschel Schachter and Rabbi Tendler were debating this issue. And I was way too young to appreciate or understand the significance of what I was seeing. And I don't remember a thing except that I saw it and that that was the topic, which is really too bad. But this has been a hot discussion for decades. The RCA did pose certain questions in their paper. One question challenges this point that Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman made, that the integrated activity that the Rambam is talking about is from the brain, because there are other integrated activities that are based elsewhere in the body. There is a separate nervous system that governs the digestive tract, as an example. Also, there is activity governed by the brain even after brainstem death via the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus has its own system, and that can still be operational. So that's a problem. Also, what about non-organized activity that persists longer than the spasms of the lizard after its head is cut off? In other words, maybe duration matters as well. Not to mention, how do I reconcile the Gemara in Yuma, right? The Gemara that we saw, which only talked about cardiac and respiratory, you know, with this, you know, approach of using integrated movement directed by the brain. So this is controversial. I want to just show a third related source. Source number 12, the Gemara in Chulin, Chaf Aleph Amar Aleph, 21a, source number 12. It's talking about various injuries, and one of them is the decapitation that we mentioned in the Mishnah in Alos that was in source number 8. It says, Nishbara mafrekes verov basar ima. In the event, I'm not going into the Noam Stadlin article, sorry, Laser. The Nishbara mafrekes verov basar ima mitame ba'ohel. In the event that someone's neck is broken and most of the flesh with it, that person now communicates tumma. That person communicates impurity, indicating that they are considered dead. So at first, this seems to support the brain death standard. However, it's not so simple. It's not so straightforward. You could read it that way. However, if you take a look at source number 13, you find the Rambam's codification of this case. And the Rambam writes, if the neck and most of its flesh are broken, the case seen in number 12, or its back is torn open as is done to fish, or most of its trachea is severed, other cases, its esophagus is punctured in the spot that would be suitable for shechita, this animal is considered to be a living corpse. Nevela mechayim. That doesn't sound like he's calling it dead. He's invented a new term. He's invented a new category. It's a zombie. It's something else. But that doesn't sound like he means that it's dead. So that creates a real question here. If it is talking about death, and it says nothing about breathing, because it doesn't, does that mean that breathing is not a standard? How do we understand this? What exactly is is this case? We can become more confused. If you take a look at source number 14, this is from the RCA's paper. Given the fact that the Gemara in Chulin that we just saw in 12 does not bring up the question of whether respiration can be detected, it would seem that the most logical explanation would be that respiration was not checked for. In other words, this is a case where they couldn't check for breathing. It is for this reason that the Gemara needs to stress that the person who has had these various injuries is considered dead. That's why we need to list it and say a person with this condition is considered dead. Otherwise, why look at the nature of the wound if he had clearly ceased breathing? This would seem to be consistent with the context of the sugya, of the passage of the Gemara, which is not speaking of a rescue mission or a person who is otherwise actively involved with the body, but deals with a person who has encountered a possibly dead body by standing under the same roof or some other means of contact, and this person now needs to clarify his status for the laws of ritual impurity. The point that the Gemara is trying to make in this is the point that the paper is trying to make is that they didn't discuss in source number 12 the checking for breathing, not because breathing doesn't matter, but because it's a case in which the test wasn't available. You didn't have that opportunity. The issue is simply you had somebody who found himself under the same roof with such a body and now wants to know, what's my status? He's coming to you afterwards, wanting to know, what's my status? It would appear the most logical explanation is that the examination has taken place from a distance where respiration could not be detected even were it present, and the Gemara still rules that if the neck and most of its flesh are broken, has taken place, it is safe to say that he is dead without any further examination. The phrases that are in parentheses are where I translated Hebrew words that appeared in the original, so the grammar doesn't read quite right. But the statement is that you can't use this source number 12, as an indication of anything. Contemporary halachic authorities have not presented a clear, compelling explanation of these sources and how they work together. Rav Moshe Feinstein's legacy remains unclear. His early responsa explicitly reject recognition of brain death, and then there's controversy about what he believed at the end of his life, and I'm totally not going there, except to note that Rabbi Tendler insisted that Rav Moshe did accept it. The RCA has an entire section in their 2010 paper dedicated to disagreeing with Rabbi Tendler's read of Rav Moshe's position, and that's all I can really say, because otherwise we will not get through this session, or the next one, for that matter. Rav Soloveitchik did not publish a position on this issue. According to numerous people who were close to him, he did not accept the brain death standard and did not feel he could answer the question. If you take a look at source number 15, Rav Meir Twersky, grandson of Rav Soloveitchik, reports that he had conversations with his grandfather regarding, quote, brain death. He says that the Rav insisted that it was a great suffix, a great doubt, that he believed could not be resolved. He was not even sure if the Gaon, the Vilna Gaon, could be Machria, could resolve this were he alive today. And then he quotes another grandson, Rav Yitzchak Lichtenstein, also had a number of conversations with his grandfather regarding brain death and transplantation, both before and after the date mentioned by Rav Twersky above. He, too, reports the Rav viewed the matter as a great suffix, a great doubt, one that he was not even sure the Vilna Gaon could resolve. He mentioned that on more than one occasion, the Rav commented that he did not understand how anyone could think they could resolve this question and permit it. Rav Soloveitchik simply felt, I am not able to resolve these sources and give you a proper answer. It's very important to recognize that in the halachic system, there is such a thing as I don't know. It isn't that everything has an answer that I'm going to be able to come to. And on this issue, they simply said, we don't know how to resolve this. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, in his writing in Israel, was against the brain death standard. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham wrote about this at length in the Nishmas Avram, Yerodea Shin Lamed Tes. Rav Shlomo Zalman argued that brain death is not found as a standard in the Gemara and that we're not able to invent it. Rabbi Tendler wrote to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach seeking to change his mind. He was not successful. There is a classic story that we are not going to discuss about a pregnant sheep where there's a discussion in the Gemara about if a pregnant woman passes away, will the fetus die first or will she die first? And they tried to figure out when somebody dies by actually putting to death a pregnant sheep and seeing whether the fetus lived or did not live. But I'm not going to discuss that at any length beyond the already difficult parts that I've already mentioned, other than to say that it did not change Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's mind. I brought you source number 16, but in the interest of time, I'm not going to read it aloud. But in there, it's Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg talking about the position of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, saying that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach concluded, like Rav Soloveitchik, that this is simply a doubt. It's not something that we would be able to resolve. But Rav Shlomo Zalman said, in the event that he would accept brain death, it would mean the death of every cell in the brain, which Rabbi Dr. Steinberg found extremely difficult, and for clear and logical reasons, not just because it's exceedingly impractical, but because when we talk about cessation of cardiac function, we don't mean that every cell in the heart is dead. Like, why would that suddenly be a requirement when you're dealing with the brain? It's very hard to understand. In 1986, the Israeli chief rabbinate accepted brain death as the standard. We have articles from Rav Shaul Yisraeli, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, who are two of the leading halachic authorities involved in that conversation. Today in Israel, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg continues to support that as the standard. There's much to say on that as well. The result, though, is fundamentally controversy without consensus and rabbinic rulings across the spectrum. And when Canada says, to go back where we started, that now we accept that it's the neurological criteria that are the essence, and cardio, you know, and respiratory as it supports neurological, that's clearly a position that will be problematic for many, many Jews and many, many halachic authorities, even though the chief rabbinate in Israel does indeed accept it to this day and operate on that basis for things like organ donation. Okay. That brings us to permanent versus irreversible. I'm just going to pause to take questions and comments first. Yes, Dr. Felder.
The question I have is whether, given the what sounds like the legitimate controversy, although I appreciate you're saying majority view and minority views, to the extent that we talk about patient autonomy, can patients choose which one we want to go by?
Yes. Yes. The answer is yes. The question was whether patients are allowed to choose. And in every area of halacha, there is the recourse to the posig, to the halachic authority. And to say, I'm not capable of resolving this, there is this great rabbi who says X, even if he's not the rabbi you follow on any other issue. It is still legitimate as long as you don't follow two contradictory positions. That's the only thing you have to make sure of, is that you don't follow two contradictory positions at the same time. But otherwise, yes. There is, I forget where I saw this. I think it was in the RCA paper from 2010 that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein had a student who... There was some tragic event that took place. I don't remember if it was from a terrorist attack or something else. And they wanted to donate organs using the brain death standard. And Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was not a supporter of the brain death standard. He followed the position of his father-in-law, Rav Soloveitchik, to be solidly uncertain. And but he did not stop them from doing it. He saw what the student wanted to do, and he did not get in the way.
So to be very practical, just to follow up on this, If a person chooses a rav, with regard to advanced directives, and says, "You're the rav that I want. You work with my family," and when it gets push comes to shove, it may or may not be where you, dear rav, hold. But I want you to know that I want to go by break. Is that something that a rav would then say? Sure, I get it. I may not agree again with the proviso that you're not doing two conflicting opinions. Is that a reasonable expectation that somebody like me who might speak to Rav and say, I'd like you to follow that particular thing?
So it's an interesting question that gets to the mechanics of Psak, but I feel like it would be unfair to ask a rabbi who did not personally subscribe to this view on such a, you know, a serious matter, ask them to execute it, no pun intended. I feel like, you know, you'd have to look to somebody else to be the one who's going to carry this out and sign off on it. I think that's correct. Yeah. Sam, is that Edmonton or Vancouver?
I'm actually in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles. Still out west. Okay.
Yeah. From Edmonton to Toronto. With all due respect, Rob, I have to disagree. I don't think there is autonomy that can be given to a patient to decide whether they want cardiac or brain death criteria. And the reason is practical. If somebody is involved in a serious accident whereby there is evidence that there is cessation of brain function, and we're talking about brain stem, which is really the control center of the brain, the patient usually will be intubated on a respirator and kept alive because of the machine, plus medications to maintain blood pressure and so on and so forth. If the patient says, or the person says, I want to have cardiac criteria, you could be in a situation where the person could be on a machine and medications for a long period of time without really any real possibility of regaining consciousness or being alive without that machine. And there's a few cases in the literature.
Oh, yeah. They're famous.
Right, where there's challenges in court about keeping somebody that is brain dead by criteria, which is difficult to do. It's not an easy thing that you just go and say, okay, you know, the criteria is very strict on how it's been done. So I don't think that a person can choose one way or another. To me, it wouldn't make any sense. And I wouldn't follow. I would have a hard time following that.
Yeah. No, there are quite a few well-known cases. You're right about that. But I want to distinguish between what Dr. Felder was asking about and what you're talking about. What Dr. Felder was talking about was the question of, within the halachic system, is it legitimate for somebody to say, I want to follow halachic authority X, even though the majority do not take that view? His question was within the halachic system. You're talking about a different question, which is, what is secular society willing and capable of accepting when a Jewish patient is brought into the hospital and the Jewish patient's family says, and it doesn't have to be Jewish, but that we're Jews, the Jewish family says, we subscribe to X standard, which is different from what society in general is doing. That's a different question. The question of what halacha recognizes for autonomy within Judaism is different from the question of whether a Jew is able to say to society, we expect you to honor our cultural standards. I happen to think that a society that claims, as North American society does, to honor individual communities, and not to force them to comply to a particular, you know, universal standard on many issues, I think they're in trouble when it comes to this issue. To suddenly say, well, we're not willing to respect it, we're not willing to honor it now, and to selectively honor, I think that creates issues. I don't think that's straightforward, but that's a separate problem.
I agree, but I wasn't talking about that. I'm talking about from the practical point of view.
Yeah.
As a physician treating somebody, whether you're Jewish or not Jewish, and forgetting about society, right? Forget about society for a second, because then we get into a whole new aspect of what we're dealing with. But it's just the individual physician treating the individual patient and what is going through. I just don't think that autonomy, to me, with all due respect, makes any sense because of the very different scenarios that one can happen or the other can happen.
Right. I'll tell you what, we've got 20 minutes to go and I've got three hands up on this issue. So I'll take the three hands quickly, but then we're going to go because irreversible is really the bigger issue that we need to wrestle with in terms of the new changes. So I don't remember who was first, so I'll take it in the order I see it on the screen. Leia.
I was last, but just very quickly, in Israel, do you think I don't know what you know. Do you know if they would have more autonomy? Because I tend to agree with Dr. Makusha Demmer. I don't think there's any room for it really in the hospital system. I don't know. You were giving an example before. Do you think in Israel they take it more into account?
So I don't know the system. I do not know. It's a good question, but I don't have an answer on that one. Does anybody quickly know how it's done in Israel? It's one thing I can. No, the question is, if you had a family in the hospital who subscribed to cardiorespiratory, would that be honored in an Israeli hospital?
The way the Israeli law is, according to Rabbi Steinberg, is that every family has the choice to follow either opinion, and it is not up to the physician, it's up to the family.
So they do have the autonomy. Interesting. Okay, good to know. Thank you. Dr. Pop.
Yeah, I just was going to say the issue of taking a separate approach is allowed in two states in the United States. In New Jersey, the family can say, we don't hold by brain death, and one is not permitted under New Jersey law to declare that patient dead except by cardiorespiratory criteria. And in New York, it's a slightly different thing called reasonable accommodation, where each institution has to have a policy of how they accommodate a family that does not hold by brain death. Mm-hmm. And how they do that can vary a little bit from institution to institution. Usually it is not escalating care, not increasing pressors or adding anything new. And sometimes it is a period of time to allow the family to find an alternate location for the patient to be cared for before they will declare the patient dead and discontinue the ventilator.
Got it. Thank you. Yeah, that's the Jayan McMath case, was California to New Jersey, if I remember correctly, in order to take advantage of that. Right. Okay, Dr. Kirshen, and then we're going to move on.
A couple of quick things. Number one, in Ontario, you can, to my knowledge, establish whatever criteria you want in terms of death by writing it into a prior power of attorney for personal care, as I believe that,
mm-hmm.
and put it there.
Got it.
So you can, to some extent, deal with autonomy. And therefore, you can, if it's available in the emergency room, which it usually is not, potentially affect it through that.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what I saw when I was in Israel, the doctors are going to listen to the family, whatever the doctors happen to think. But the law that Laser is talking about from Dr. Steinberg was explicitly written with transplantation in mind. And I think it's worth keeping that in mind. The third thing is, the article you keep quoting from Canadian Journal of Anesthesia that I pointed out was written by doctors. And the first criteria, I'm sorry, I apologize for being proud here. I'm the one who criticized them for saying, did you bother to ask the community?
Mm-hmm.
They did not. So there is a problem, and it isn't a legal standard at this time.
Interesting. So I think my understanding was that it did become a legal standard, but I'll defer to you because I'm not in Canada at this point. But I thought it did actually become accepted as the standard. But I'm going to... Leah, is that an answer on this point?
In that same journal,
yes,
there's actually an interesting article. They did a survey on different intensivists.
Yes.
And also, I mean, they do... It is focused on brain death. But they all judge it differently. They all have different, even though there are recommendations and standards, it seems to be a free-for-all, which is a little scary.
Got it.
As to how far they investigate it.
Interesting. Okay, I'm going to go further at this point because there's way too much to talk about. And David, thank you for your notes. Understood. Moving into the permanent and irreversible issues. So this is a key point of conflict. What is the status of patients whose organs have stopped functioning if we are capable of reversing that stoppage? Historically, and I'm going to jump over some of the material that I gave you on the sheets just in the interest of time, in order to get to particular elements, but historically, the standard was irreversibility. Whether it's cessation of the heart function, whether it's cessation of respiratory function, whether it's cessation of the brain's function, didn't make a difference. It was about whether something happened that was irreversible. Source number 17 refers you to the Pittsburgh Protocol in 1993 for procurement of organs from adults after cardiac death. It was always about it being irreversible. That was the way it was supposed to work. But in truth, both cessation of cardiac function and cessation of neurological function may prove reversible. The only question is, do we actually plan to reverse them? We know that cardiac function, cessation of cardiac function is reversible because that's what you do in a heart transplant. Is that it actually starts functioning again? Dr. Robert Veach, in the article that I brought in source number 17, talks about this, and he says, if you can restore the heart to functioning in a transplant, then it obviously is reversible. There is a lot of debate on this issue. Source number 18 and source number 19 were a point-counterpoint that appeared in the journal Chest on exactly this issue. Does normothermic regional perfusion, which is where you are pumping fluids in to keep the organ viable, does that violate the ethical principles underlying organ procurement? And source number 18 says, you bet, it definitely is violating the protocols. And then on the other hand, source number 19 says, nah, there's more to say, obviously. I'm oversimplifying because I've got 13 minutes to go. But this is a fascinating ethical debate, and it becomes even stronger when they talk about clamping off the blood vessels to the brain to ensure that what they're perfusing the body with does not reach the brain, lest that have an effect of restoring some level of brain function. So that if you take a look on the sheet at source number 21, which is a New York Times article on this, the first problem some ethicists and surgeons say stems from the way death has traditionally been defined. The heart has stopped, circulation of blood has irreversibly ceased. Because the new procedure involves restarting blood flow, critics say it essentially invalidates the earlier declaration of death. But that may be a minor problem compared to an additional step surgeons take. They use metal clamps to cut blood flow from the revived heart to the donor's head to limit blood flow to the brain to prevent the possibility that any brain activity is restored. Some physicians and ethicists say that is a tacit admission that the donor might not be legally dead. It's kind of a creepy thing to be doing. Right? Isn't it a creepy thing to be doing? Like you have the ability to restore some level of brain function, and in order to avoid problems, we're just going to clamp it off in order so that doesn't become an issue for us. And lest one say this is only heart and not neurological, that is not true. In April of 2019, they managed in an experiment at Yale to perfuse pigs' brains with something they called Brain X, a fluid made mainly of a synthetic hemoglobin, and they actually found that cells in the pigs' brains came back to life. That does not mean the brains were back to functioning. That's not what they succeeded in doing, but it was, as described in source number 22 from the American Journal of Bioethics, in a cellularly active brain where it had not been before. And then they did a follow-up experiment in August of 2022 where they used a similar device and they did it just for the brain. And as you see in the article, pigs were anesthetized. Then they were killed with induced cardiac arrest. After about an hour near body temperature, the dead pig's blood vessels are filled with this new fluid that they're using called Organ X, and it manages to support cells in the brain, still not restoring brain function, let's be very clear, but raising the question of what we're capable of doing and what in the world this would do to the standard for death. So the Canadian change that, again, my understanding was it was actually implemented as a law. I'm not clear on you know, Dr. Kirshen is saying that it's not. But what they're revising, the revision of the standard, is to say, let's stop talking about irreversible, and let's say instead that the standard is permanent. Permanent means not that it can't be reversed, but if you look at source number 23, the part in italics towards the end, while irreversible means cannot be reversed under any circumstances, permanent means will not resume spontaneously and will not be reversed through intervention for normative reasons. So we aren't going to reverse it. That's what permanent means. And so my question is, what would halacha say about reversible death? Whatever your standard is, doesn't matter. Your standard is heart, your standard is lungs, your standard is brainstem, whatever your standard is. What happens if it can stop and then we are capable of restarting it? And I don't mean it stops because of some acute circumstance like hypothermia, but like it stopped. We did all the tests. It's no longer functioning, but then we're able to restart it. So based on a passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi, it seems that reversible death is not really death. There's a lot of discussion regarding open heart surgery, and this is why I linked for you the article in the beginning of the shiur, I should say, in the beginning of the source sheet, where I gave a shiur about the total artificial heart, because it came up in that shiur. There's a lot of discussion about open heart surgery. If you take cardiac function as the test of death, during open heart surgery, they stop the heart. So how can you be allowed to engage in open heart surgery? Obviously, you are allowed, but why is that okay? You're killing the patient. So Rabbi J. David Bleich, in an article on this, offered three justifications. His first justification, and Laser, you quoted Noam Stadlin before, he really doesn't like this suggestion. But the first suggestion from Rabbi Bleich is that death is not really about the heart per se, it's about something called vital motion, which includes the heartbeat, but can be there even if the heart is artificially stopped. That's a very interesting idea that I'm not going into, but that's his first suggestion. It's about the vital motion as opposed to the heartbeat. Rabbi Bleich's second approach, which I'm also not going into, is that it's not really about the heart, it's about circulation, and that is still going on during open heart surgery. And then his third approach is the interesting one. He says, if cessation is reversible, then the patient is not really dead. If you're able to reverse it, the patient isn't dead. What is this based on? The answer is, it's based on something from the 18th century, the Chida in the Birkei Yosef. The Chida was asked whether reversible death is death. The case at hand is the Gemara in Megillah, which is usually discussed Purim time, in which Rabba and Rabbi Zera sit down for their Purim feast. Rabba becomes intoxicated, and if you read the Gemara literally, he kills Rabbi Zera. Feeling very bad about it, he brings him back to life. So the question is, as the question goes to the Chidah, to Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, is Rabbi Zera now in need of a new wedding to his wife? If he died, his wife is a widow. Now that he's back to life, does he have to marry her all over again or not? So Rabbi Azulai says, no, a reversed death is not death. And he bases it on a passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi in Gittin. To make a long story short, the core text there is a Mishnah that says, if a man gives his wife a conditional bill of divorce, a conditional get, he says, if I don't come back in 12 months, then this is a valid get. Right? He's doing it because he doesn't want his wife to be stuck. If he disappears, he wants to make sure she's going to be divorced and able to remarry and not worry about Yibum and so on. So he gives his wife such a document. And then he dies after 6 months. And everybody knows he's dead. So the question now is she divorced because he's not coming back after 12 months? Or is she a widow at this point, in which case, potentially, she has to marry her brother-in-law or do chalitza or something along those lines? And is she able to remarry between month number 6 and month number 12? When he's not back yet, but we know he's not coming back. So the Gemara asks whether she has to wait for the 12 months to remarry. Gemara Gittin Ayin Vav Amud Beis. And the and is not conclusive. But the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, in source number 25, addresses this question and says the following. May she marry? Rabbi Chagai said she may marry. Rabbi Yossi said she may not marry. Why? I say perhaps miracles were performed for him and he lived. We think he's dead, but maybe a miracle, this is the way that the Birkei Yosef, Rabbi Azulai, reads it, maybe a miracle will restore the husband to life. Not that he didn't die, but maybe he will be resurrected. So you have to wait the full 12 months. So is presented, that is the argument of Rabbi Yossi in the Gemara. So Rabbi Azulai says, in practice we reject Rabbi Yossi's view, because it's really, really unlikely. We do not have a track record of people being resurrected. That's not, you know, the normal course of things. But in principle, and this is the key point, if Rabbi Yossi's case were to come to pass, this husband were to come back to life, he would be viewed as still married to the woman he was married to before. No new kiddushin is necessary. I said that really fast, but you follow? No new marriage is necessary. He's still married to her. So that proves that a reversed death is not really death. And Rabbi Bleich invokes that in order to make exactly that argument. Rabbi Azulai's comments are in source number 26. Rabbi Bleich is in source number 27. He says, in the event that this person's death is reversed, the person was never dead in the first place, irreversibility should be the halachic standard. Not permanent, but irreversible. However, there's a Tosfos that I think may indicate otherwise, depending on how you read it. And bear with me, we have 3 minutes left. It may take me five, but it's a fascinating five. So let's see what we can do. You may know, there are midrashim that talk about Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah the prophet, as a Kohen. Well, Tanakh, in the book of Malachim, it's in source number 28, describes Eliyahu Hanavi doing somebody a favor, bringing their apparently dead child back to life. The woman says to him, her child has died. He goes to the child. He does what some people consider an early version of CPR. Leave aside whether it is or it is not. Doesn't matter. But he brings the child back to life. Question arises, how could he do that? Eliyahu is a Kohen. A Kohen is not allowed to come in contact with the dead. How could Eliyahu do this to bring the child back to life? So Rabbi David Ibn Avi Zimra, in a responsum which I brought you in source number 29, has multiple approaches, including an approach saying that the child was not truly dead. The text is kind of like he's dead. It sure seems to me like he's dead, but you could sort of squeeze that in. Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin supported this read, that the child is not really dead, because there's a Gemara in Nida Ayin Amud Beis in which the Alexandrians ask the sages a question about the boy who Eliyahu's student, resurrected, and his status, and don't ask the question about Eliyahu and his student, suggesting that maybe Eliyahu's resurrection was not real. It was actually that the child had never died. So that's one argument. The child wasn't dead, Eliyahu didn't become impure, and everybody's fine. However, and this is the key point, the Ri in Tosfos, in source number 30, didn't give that answer. He asked the question, how could Eliyahu have done it? In source number 30. And you know what his answer is? His answer is Eliyahu could do it because he knew for sure that the child would live, and therefore this was a case of pikuach nefesh. This was the case of saving a life, because he knew for sure the child could be brought back to life. Tosfos is not saying, as the Radbaz did in source number 29, that the child was really alive. Tosfos believes the child was dead. Eliyahu was becoming impure, but it was justified by saving a life. So does Tosfos indicate that even if it's reversible, death is death? In other words, we could be okay with the Canadian government switching from irreversible to permanent if they do make that switch? That's the question. But the answer is maybe not. We could argue that this case is different because Eliyahu's resurrection of the child was miraculous. This wasn't a case in which you could resurrect somebody through natural means. I don't care if it looks like CPR. CPR doesn't work with people who have passed away. I'm pretty sure of that one. Not a doctor, pretty sure. So the point here is that on the one hand, you can make the argument that Tosvos is saying that death is death, even if it can be reversed. But you could also argue that that's not true, because this was a case of miraculous reversal. But Tosos would agree that in a case of natural reversal, that in fact, it's not called death in the first place. You could still make that argument that we can't bring proof from here. So what I have at the end of the day is a Yerushalmi, which says that reversible death is not death. That's number one. And number two, I have a Tosfos that maybe you could read as saying the opposite, but you could read it two different ways. I rushed that a lot. I'm going to stay on late to discuss further if people want to do so. Either way, I think the idea of using clamping to prevent blood from reaching the brain would seem to be extremely problematic if that could actually restore life, not just keeping a couple of cells going. But if it could restore life, the idea that we're going to say, sorry, we want to keep the organs going for transplant, but we're not interested in creating a problem by having the brain functioning, that would be a real problem. So what I'm going to do now is this, because we've reached the 9:30 point. I'm going to let anybody go who needs to go. Make sure you signed in the chat, please, in order to get credit. And then I'll tell you about the last case, the anesthesiologist who wanted to know about engaging in thoracoabdominal normothermic regional perfusion to enable a heart transplant. Okay, so those who need to go can go. You'll still get credit, but I'm going to just go for a couple of minutes because it's an interesting case to know about. Okay, we're good?
For a question or not yet?
I'll do the question after because I just want to get to the story for people. Fair? Okay, so this is what happened. This is in May of 2015. An anesthesiologist who followed the view that says that it's cardio respiratory function that is the definition of life and death, not brain function, came to me because he was trained in perfusing a body, or perfusing an organ, I think it was the body, with certain fluids to enable the organs to remain viable so that a transplant could be done. And the patient is only brain dead. So his question was, am I allowed to assist in this process by perfusing the body in order to keep the organs viable and going? Am I allowed to, or am I in violation of halacha by doing so? I said that a little quickly, but it was clear? The question is clear? Yes? Okay. So I was in a panic because this was like an immediate question. This wasn't like a hypothetical down the line. And I'm certainly not on the level of being able to answer questions like that. So I did what you're never supposed to do as a rabbi, which is I sent it to two different halachic authorities, hoping that I would get an answer in time. You're never supposed to do that, because what might happen is what did happen, which is I heard back from both of them, and they said different things. I'll name one of them because I know that he doesn't mind being named. I'm not going to name the other one because I didn't ask him for permission. But the one who will remain nameless said, you're not allowed. The anesthesiologist would not be allowed to participate in this because he is assisting in them taking organs from somebody who is still actually halachically alive, Granted, you are not the one doing it. The anesthesiologist was not going to be the one to actually clamp off the organs in the end and declare death. That wasn't, you know, all of that was not his role. Nonetheless, because it couldn't be done without you, therefore you're not allowed to do it. That was one halachic authority's answer. The other answer came from the Nishmas Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham. And he said to me that the anesthesiologist is allowed to do it. He said, the patient is alive, the heart is beating because of what was done in the ICU before the anesthesiologist ever got involved. All you are doing is maintaining the patient in this living state, what we consider, if you don't accept the brain death standard, what we consider to be a living state. He's not going to be the one to determine death. He's not going to be the one to take the organ. Add in the fact that he could lose his job because he ends up responsible for this at night when he's the only one there. There's nobody else available. So you can't say, well, I'm referring it to somebody else. And therefore, the Nishmas Avram's answer is that this was acceptable for him to do so. So I thought that was a very interesting event. And yeah, I've never done that since, of asking two different people. But I did ask at that point. Mistake. Okay, Laser, what was your question?